Hello, welcome to the reading of the Cedar Rapids Gazette for today. Today is Thursday, September 15. I'm your reader, Kathleen. From the front page of the Gazette today, state grant opens hundreds of child care spots in East Iowa. This story is by Grace King and Aaron Murphy for the Gazette and includes a photo of Harlow Roberts, left, age 4, identifies shapes on her Shapes Pizza as classmate Gilbert Hansen, also 4, and teacher Danielle Phippen look on during Wednesday afternoon preschool session at Tilford Elementary in Vinton. The program was awarded a $1.5 million state grant to add an early learning center with before and after school care. A state grant is paving the way for the creation of an early learning center in the Vinton-Shelsburg Community School District to provide that before and after care for preschool students. The school district was awarded $1.5 million to build an early learning center at Tilford Elementary School, located at 308 East 13th Street in Vinton. The center, named the Tiny Vikes Early Learning Center, will house a 3- and 4-year-old half-day preschool program and child care for those students from 6:30 a.m. to 6 p.m. Monday through Friday. This project will expand the current before and after school program for children kindergarten through fourth grade and add 52 child care slots to the area. Vinton-Shelsburg Superintendent Kyle Copen said the goal was to build enough space for everyone who needs child care services in the area. If we want to keep attracting younger families, we need to make sure we're providing these amenities. We know it's an essential feature a lot of families look for, and we're working hard to provide it, he said. Even some of the district's own teachers send their preschool-aged children to other school districts because of the built-in child care services, Kepper said. A child care center at one of the district's preschool programs will eliminate transportation barriers some families face. The project is among 23 statewide selected to receive grants totaling $26.6 million in state funding. The vast majority of the grant funding will go toward infrastructure projects, while a small portion will support agreements between child care centers and businesses to create new child care slots. According to the state, the grants will impact 67 employers and create more than 1,700 child care slots. Iowa businesses know that access to quality child care is a major factor in employees' ability to work, Iowa Governor Kim Reynolds said in a news release. These awards will support and incentivize employer investment in child care resources on-site or through community partnerships, and strengthen our efforts to provide high-quality child care throughout the state of Iowa. The state's Child Care Business Incentive Grant was created this year. It was one of the recommendations made in a state task force report. Not only do the grants help employers create or expand child care for existing workers, but they also enhance their ability to be successful in attracting and retaining new employees, Iowa Workforce Development Director Beth Townsend said in a news release. Our focus moving forward must remain on addressing these specific types of barriers to provide options for families and create an environment where the local workforce can thrive. True North Companies in Cedar Rapids also is a recipient of the grant. It was awarded almost $2.8 million to create a child care center for its employees in Cedar Rapids. True North is partnering with Kids Point Early Learning Center in Cedar Rapids to manage the program, which will add 100 new child care slots to the area. At the heart of it is knowing when our colleagues are feeling secure and confident in their child care, they can be activated and engaged wholehearted colleagues with us, said Mallory Mowinkle, Director of Creative at True North. There are over 200 True North employees in the Cedar Rapids area and 500 nationwide, Mowinkle said. True North leadership is committed to our colleagues and families and the future of our organization and community, she said. We're appreciative of the funding being made available. To the Rescue, a home health service in Cedar Rapids, was awarded $2.5 million to create 100 new child care slots. The nonprofit is planning to build a child care facility in Cedar Rapids to serve children who live in Linn County. West Liberty Foods in West Liberty received a $750,000 grant through the program, which it is matching, partnering with West Liberty Child Care Center to double its capacity to 96 kids. Up to 40 slots will be reserved for West Liberty Foods employees. Brian Melhus with West Liberty Foods said child care is one of the primary needs of their workforce. "We're very thankful the state recognizes this as a need for employers," Melhus said. "There are about 900 West Liberty Foods employees in a town of 4,000 with only one state-licensed early child care facility. The need for child care is great, and we certainly look forward to expanding." The state said it plans to award a second round of child care grant funding. Applications are being accepted at iowagrants.gov and are due by October 17. Also on the front page today, this story by Vanessa Miller: coaches seek dismissal of UI discrimination case. Hawkeye head football coach Kirk Ferentz, offensive coordinator Brian Ferentz, former strength coach Christopher Doyle, and other University of Iowa defendants recently have piled on requests that a judge dismiss a federal discrimination lawsuit against them, calling it too vague, too broad, and too late. But former players suing them for discrimination, retaliation, and systemic racial hostility are firing back, accusing the coaches of dodging, delaying, and hiding behind attorneys to avoid producing court-compelled records and participating in the legal process. Brian Ferentz is a key defendant in this matter, who has direct allegations asserted against him for overt conduct. According to the players' recent request, the court delay any decision on motions to drop their case and compel UI cooperation. Plaintiffs respectfully request that this honorable court defer considering the summary judgment or deny the relief requested by defendant Brian Ferentz, allow plaintiffs to obtain production of documents from defendant Brian Ferentz, and take defendant Brian Ferentz's deposition. Players, who in November 2020 filed a lawsuit accusing the Hawkeye program of fostering a racially discriminatory culture and committing specific racist offenses through their attorneys this month, said the Hawkeye program continues to refuse to turn over all court-ordered documents. The court ordered the defendants to produce the documents relating to the Hush Blackwell investigation by July 11, 2022, according to the players. When defendants produced documents related to the Hush Blackwell investigation in accordance with the court's order, a review of those documents revealed that defendants had withheld documents the court ordered them to produce. UI Athletics in early 2020 hired Hush Blackwell to conduct an independent and external review of the Hawkeye football program, which faced allegations of racism and discrimination from numerous former players. That review produced several reports, including on specific coaches like Kirk and Brian Ferentz and Doyle, with whom UI signed a $1.3 million separation agreement. Although UI publicly shared a summary report confirming the football program, quote, perpetuated racial or cultural biases and diminished the value of cultural diversity, end quote, it withheld Hush Blackwell personnel reports on coaches asserting privacy laws. Over the summer, a judge ordered UI to turn over all materials the former players requested relating to the review, despite claims of attorney-client privilege. In addition to those outstanding records, UI and its attorneys also have not made individuals available for deposition, which involves taking sworn out-of-court testimony for use in court, including Brian Ferentz. While players awaited the requested documents and depositions, UI and its coaches this month filed motions asking a judge to dismiss the case and rule in their favor, having already conducted depositions of the players who are suing them. In what appears to be a public relations move in advance of the 2022 college football season, defendant Brian Ferentz prematurely filed the summary judgment and summary judgment brief after evading document production and depositions for nearly a year, according to the players. In addition to Brian Ferentz's August motion for a summary judgment in his favor, he, along with head coach Kirk Ferentz, Seth Wallace, Gary Barta, UI, and the Board of Regents this month, filed motions asking the judge to dismiss certain counts against them. Kirk Ferentz, in his September 2 filing, accused some of the suing players of failing to allege any specific acts against the coaches, let alone Kay Ferentz, within the two-year look-back period. Throughout the coaches' requests, they cite records and recordings the players have produced and depositions they sat for, poking holes in changing stories and unfounded accusations. They also argue the players, having been with the Hawkeye program as far back as 2015, are time-barred from making legal claims and that they failed to offer supported specific allegations. Several of the claims of plaintiffs must be dismissed because plaintiffs have failed to plead sufficient facts, according to the UI request for dismissal. Hawkeye linebackers coach Seth Wallace added to the lawsuit in the spring, more than a year after the original complaint, in his request for dismissal argued the players can't just attach him to the allegations that originally excluded him. Plaintiffs originally sued several Iowa football coaches whom they believed were liable and omitted Wallace. Plaintiffs knew the identity of Wallace but ignored him, according to Wallace's request. There was no mistake here as to plaintiffs naming a wrong party in the sense of a misnamed or wrongly named party, and absent such mistake, there can be no relation back to claims against a new party to the time filing of the original petition. Former Hawkeye strength coach Doyle on Monday filed a separate request for summary judgment, arguing, among other things, the lawsuit came too late and failed to make sufficient arguments. In making his case, Doyle said, until the morning on June 5, 2020, when social media exploded with allegations against the football program, no one had ever made a complaint against him that was in any way related to racial discrimination, racial slurs, or treating anyone differently because of their race. Doyle has consistently received exemplary performance evaluations during his time at the university, according to his motion. Former players and coaches, including those involved with the University of Iowa Strength and Conditioning Program, at the same time as plaintiffs, have never witnessed Doyle engaging in any racially discriminatory behavior. Throughout his motion, Doyle cites the players' depositions, which they sat for in the spring, like from Akram Wadley, a star UI running back from 2015 to 2017. Mr. Wadley acknowledged under oath that Doyle never used the N-word and never said anything about his hair, jewelry, tattoos, other than Wadley's belief that neither Doyle nor coach Kirk Ferentz liked players wearing hoodies, according to Doyle's argument. Players, in responding to the coaches, argue they don't have the information they need to argue their case. As has been widely and thoroughly discussed in multiple status conferences, before this honorable court, defendants' counsel did not respond to plaintiffs' attempts to obtain deposition dates for defendants, including Brian Ferentz and other key witnesses, according to the players. Instead, the players accused Ferentz of trying to hide by prematurely moving for dismissal, making highly objectionable legal conclusions on disputed facts, saying, simply, he did no wrong. Brian Ferentz stated, I deny that I asked Wadley if he were going to rob a liquor store, gas station, bank, or any other place. According to the player's request, the court denied his motion, calling that an example of the many, many assertions lodged and addressed in defendant Brian Ferentz's affidavit that he must address in a deposition taken under oath and subject to cross-examination. Defendants cannot be afforded the opportunity to refuse to respond to requests to depose witnesses, including Brian Ferentz, and then seek summary judgment in a case involving conduct that this honorable court has referred to as vile, the players argue. Turning now to the Iowa Today page, this story by Grace King, retired teacher, joins Iowa City School Board. Former Iowa City West High School educator Molly Abraham will join the Iowa City School Board. The board appointed Abraham to succeed former board president Sean Eystone, who resigned last month. Abraham will serve the rest of Eystone's term, which expires next year. In her application for the board seat, she said she was unsure if she will seek election in November 2023. Abraham worked in the Iowa City District for 38 years as a special education teacher at West and later as the school's assistant principal. "I bring an extensive knowledge of the Iowa City educational system with the perspective of a parent, teacher, and administrator," Abraham wrote in her application. "I have watched the district grow into the diverse and extraordinary school community it is today. If you spoke with the students, families, and staff I have collaborated with over the years, they would tell you I have excellent problem-solving abilities," Abraham wrote. Abraham retired in June of 2020, but was asked to return for 2 years as part-time administrative support at West High and Northwest Junior High. Abraham was one of six people who applied for the open position. The six were given time to address the school board in a special meeting last week. The school board chose to appoint a board member instead of holding a special election, which is costly. Brady Shute, president of the Iowa City Education Association, said Abraham will be a fantastic director. "Many people in our community and district hold Molly in the highest regard, professionally and personally," he said. School board president Ruthina Malone encouraged the other applicants to stay involved and thank them for their interest. Board member Maka Pilcher-Hayek said she's bragged about the resumes the board received. "The kind of people applying for this job are doing it because you care about public education and want to serve. I'm so impressed by everyone," she said. Also on the Iowa Today page, this Grace King story: voters approve $15.7 million for Anamosa High Gym. The Anamosa Community School District is getting a new competition gym after voters approved a $15.7 million general obligation bond Tuesday to fund the project. Almost 70% of voters approved the addition of a second gym to the high school at 209 Sadie Street. The gym will have an indoor track, weight room, locker room, and other amenities. An additional $6.3 million will come from sales tax revenue to fund the project, which is projected to cost $22 million. Property tax rates will not increase because the district has paid off existing debts. The gym will be built on the north side of the high school. It will create easier scheduling for athletic practices so athletes can avoid early morning and late evening practices. It also allows for additional space for youth teams and activities. A 168-meter, four-lane indoor track will encircle the gym at the ground level. The track will have a cushioned layer topped by a rubber surface. An additional parking lot will be created on the practice field east of the school. Bleachers will have a capacity for about 1,850 people, larger than the current gym's 1,000-seat capacity. This will enable Anamosa to host larger events. As of Tuesday, there were 6,150 registered voters in the Anamosa School District, predominantly in Jones County, with 277 registered voters in Linn County. A total of 1,237 votes were cast for 20% voter turnout. And this Marissa Payne story is titled, "City Urges Ingredient Union to End Strike." The Cedar Rapids City Council is unanimously calling for ingredient managers with the Bakery, Confectionery, Tobacco Workers, and Grain Millers International Union Local 100G to bargain in good faith and bring an end to the union strike against the multinational ingredient maker. The strike began August 1st. In a copy of the guest column provided to the Gazette on Wednesday, the nine-member council writes, "There are no winners in a protracted labor strike, as it encouraged the union and company to sit down together and bargain in good faith. Labor strikes hit at the heart of the community," the guest column states. "Families suffer, customers are lost, long-term damage to the mental health of workers and their families occur, and long-term damage to a business and its brand are the result. Put aside your differences and negotiate professionally and ethically to do what is in the best interest of our community, and that is to get back to work. The sticking points between the union and Ingredion are primarily health care benefits, wages, and overtime pay, and Ingredion's plan to eliminate 5 union laboratory positions. The facility has 127 hourly union employees and 46 salaried non-union employees, according to Becca Harry, Ingredion Corporate Communications Director. Ingredion stated in a full-page advertisement in Monday's Gazette it stands ready to continue talks. The company is standing by its commitment to being a good corporate citizen in Cedar Rapids, and it has strived to be the best possible steward of this facility since acquiring it in 2015 from Penford Corp., the ad continued. Mike Moore, president of the striking local, told the Gazette the union and the corporation have a call scheduled for today about restarting discussions, after which he hopes to have a better idea when negotiations will resume. The union is committed to getting a fair and livable contract, Moore said. We look forward to sitting down with the company again. Turning now to the Insight page, the guest column today is from the Cedar Rapids City Council members and the title, Let's End This Strike. Strong cities have several key factors that make them successful. A strong industrial sector and strong labor unions. Neither one can work successfully without the other. When they work in partnership, a city can thrive and tackle hardships together. Cedar Rapids is no different. The relationship between our industries and our labor unions has been a successful partnership. It has helped us survive through floods and derechos. They have worked together through COVID and economic hard times. The contributions to our community have been invaluable and a key factor in helping Iowa's second largest city to thrive. There are no winners in a protracted labor strike. Labor strikes hit at the heart of a community. Families suffer, customers are lost, long-term damage to the mental health of workers and their families occur, and long-term damage to a business and a brand are the result. This is why the Cedar Rapids City Council encourages both the members of Local 100G of the union and the management of Ingredion to sit down together and bargain in good faith. Put aside your differences and negotiate professionally and ethically to do what is in the best interest of our community, and that is to get back to work. In times like these, our community cannot afford to have people out of work. One paycheck missed is one paycheck too many. We believe in both parties and your ability to put an end to this strike that has already lasted too long. Our community and the City Council are counting on you. And the City Council members include Mayor Tiffany O'Donnell, at-large council members Tyler Olson, Ann Poe, and Patrick Leffler, District 1 council member Marty Hoger, District 2 council member Scott Overland, District 3 council member Dale Todd, District 4 council member Scott Olson, and District 5 council member Ashley Van Orney. 24-hour doorman today is titled, Litter Box Lies Aren't Going Away. Back in May, I wrote a column about the ridiculous myth circulating across Iowa and several other states that schools are putting litter boxes in bathrooms to accommodate students who identify as animals or, quote, furries, end quote. It was prompted by a Republican state senator from Fort Dodge, Tim Kreienbrink, who told an audience at a legislative forum a school in his district installed litter boxes. When pressed, he refused to identify the school and said he was told about it in a confidential conversation. Within days, he said he misspoke and apologized for miscommunication. He spread the lie while criticizing Linmar's support policies for transgender students. So the litter box myth is a slander against those kids as part of an effort to undermine their rights and policies that uphold those rights. Kreienbrink joined a campaign of manufactured fear, led by Governor Kim Reynolds, U.S. Representative Ashley Hinson, and other top Republicans. Since I wrote that column, it has received tens of thousands of page views, averaging several hundred each week. Nearly all of those page views are generated from online searches, likely by people wondering what's up with this school litter box thing. So it wasn't a big surprise when I got a call Tuesday from a guy who lives near Philadelphia. His school district, like so many others, has been embroiled in right-wing anger over transgender support policies, allegations of teachers grooming kids, calls for book bans, and the removal of pride flags. He didn't want me to use his name or identify the school district. At a school board meeting he attended Monday night, a speaker asked, "What's next, litter boxes in bathrooms?" Confused, the guy took to Google and found my column. Litter box nonsense has been refuted again and again, and yet the lie won't die. It's a sad indicator of how little facts mean to people searching for reasons to justify discrimination and hatred. No amount of columns, articles, and fact checks pointing out the lie can kill it, so long as there are politicians willing to spread it for political gain. Speaking of Pennsylvania, Republican U.S. Representative Marjorie Taylor Greene of Georgia recently stoked the litter box fantasy ahead of a recent Trump rally in the state. A reporter from the Right Side Broadcasting Network told her about a student he heard about in Texas who identified as a cat. They're embarrassing lies. I mean, literally embarrassing lies. Okay, if some student wants to pretend like a cat and use a litter box after school, that's their prerogative, whatever. But no, the school and school resources and the other students and teachers should not have to be put through that, because it's a lie, Green said. Of course, the real lie is this isn't happening. But in Green's world, the lie is that being transgender is a real thing. In Green's world, wildfires are started by a space laser. Back in the real world, a federal judge this week refused to issue an injunction halting enforcement of Lynn Marr's transgender policies. Ruling an injunction would leave students without protection from bullying and harassment. Pulling that protection is the point of the lawsuit and the litter box lies. That's 24-hour Dorman. One community letter today, Franken supports older Iowans. While AARP does not endorse candidates, they do identify the top issues of importance to older citizens. Their list, published in the AARP's May bulletin, included prescription drugs, Social Security, Medicare, and caregiving long-term care. Admiral Mike Franken's website, frankenforiowa.com, was put together prior to AARP's May bulletin. He had listed his major issues for older Iowans, such as keeping Social Security solvent for this and future generations, proposal, make all earnings subject to the Social Security tax, expanding Medicare, proposal, make Medicare available to everyone and add coverage for vision, hearing, and dental care, lowering the cost of prescription drugs, proposal, Medicare needs to do what the Veterans Affairs does, use its national purchasing power to negotiate prices with drug companies, improving long-term care services while expanding ways to pay for them. Franken identifies 5 proposals to address these challenges. Franken addresses all 4 of AARP's issues in depth and goes further. He suggests we pay for these programs by eliminating the Trump tax cuts that benefit the wealthiest Americans and adopt a tax system where all Americans and big corporations pay their fair share. Senator Chuck Grassley's re-election website lists none of these issues as a priority. Who cares more about and will better serve older Iowans? It's obvious. Mike Franken will. He has my vote, and I hope he will have yours. And that's signed by Bob Welsh from Coralville. You are listening to the reading of the Cedar Rapids Gazette for today, Thursday, September 15, on Iris. And now we turn to today's obituaries, starting with the short notices. First, from Belle Plaine, William Bardosh, age 86, died Tuesday, September 13. Iowa cremation is assisting the family. In Kalmar, Dennis Heinker, age 93, died Monday, September 12. Helms Funeral Home, Decorah. In Cedar Rapids, Dixie Lee Gilson, age 82, formerly of Cedar Rapids, now of Anamosa, died Tuesday, September 13th. Papich Kuba Funeral Service, Cedar Rapids. Also in Cedar Rapids, Barbara Ann Smejkal, 89, died Tuesday, September 13, Cedar Memorial Park Funeral Home, Cedar Rapids. Also Robert Zager of Cedar Rapids, age 75, died Tuesday, September 13, Murdoch Funeral Home and Cremation Service, Marion. In Decorah, Keith Walsh, age 78, died Tuesday, September 13, Helms Funeral Home, Decorah. In Manchester, Carol Jean Hutchinson, 90, died Wednesday, September 14, Leonard Muller Funeral Home, Manchester. In McGregor, Calvin Eugene Corlett, age 70, died Monday, September 12, Thornburg Grau Funeral Home and Cremation Service, McGregor. And in Walker, Alan, known as Al Lee Reddick, 77, died Tuesday, September 13, Murdoch Funeral Home and Cremation Service, Central City. Turning now to the regular notices, first from Monticello, Jason John Hansen, 44, of Monticello, passed away August 27. Jason was born in Merrill, Wisconsin. He moved to Cedar Rapids in 1995 with his family. A celebration of life will be held at a later date. From Cedar Rapids, Parrish, known as P. Marcel Harris, age 30, passed away on September 6th. A celebration of life gathering will be held from 4 to 7 p.m. Friday, September 16th at Bros Chapel and the Ava Center, 2121 Bowling Street, Southwest. Online condolences may be expressed to the family at broschapel.com. From Cedar Rapids, Betty Ann Covington Long, age 83, passed away Sunday, September 11, at St. Luke's Hospital in Cedar Rapids. Funeral service is at 10:30 a.m. Saturday, September 17, at the Murdoch Linwood Funeral Home and Cremation Service, with visitation to begin 1 hour prior at the funeral home. Graveside committal will also be on Saturday at 2 p.m. at the Marengo Cemetery in Marengo, Iowa. Please share a memory of Betty at murdochfuneralhome.com. From Florence, Arizona, Vicki J. Hocken. It is with great sadness we announce the passing of Vicki Hocken, age 61, formerly of Center Point, Iowa, on September 4. Vicki was a loving mom and grandma. Cards and memorials may be directed to Mary Luke. From Cedar Rapids, Mary Faches, age 87, formerly of Cedar Rapids, died September 9. Funeral service will be at 11 a.m. Saturday, September 17th at St. John the Baptist Greek Orthodox Church in Cedar Rapids. Visitation from 5 to 7 p.m. Friday, September 16th at the Stuart Baxter Funeral and Memorial Service in Cedar Rapids, with a Trisagion service at 7 p.m. Arrangements are with Stuart Baxter Funeral and Memorial Service in Cedar Rapids. From Cedar Rapids, Pamela Klinge, age 57, passed away Monday, September 13, at the University of Iowa Hospitals and Clinics from complications of surgery. Services are at 11 a.m. Friday, September 16th at St. Andrew's Lutheran Church, where a visitation will begin at 10 a.m. until service time. Burial will be at Cedar Memorial Park Cemetery. The Reverend Roberta Pierce will officiate. Cedar Memorial Park Funeral Home is in charge of arrangements. In Iowa City, Donald H. Munson, 91, died Friday, September 2 at Mercy Hospital in Iowa City. Graveside services with military honors will be held at Long Creek Cemetery in rural Danville at 10 a.m. Saturday, September 17. Online condolences can be sent for Don's family through the web at jonesfh.com. In Cedar Rapids, Linda Morse, age 74, passed away Saturday, September 3. Services are at 1 p.m. Saturday, September 17th at Church of the Kings, 3750 F Avenue Northwest in Cedar Rapids, Pastor Chris Slama. A meal will be served after the service. In Tama, Ethel Marie Rosenberger, age 89, passed away Tuesday, September 6th at Sunny Hill Care Center in Tama. A private family graveside service will be held at Woodlawn Cemetery in Toledo. Pastor Warren Riley officiating. Visitation will be held from 4 to 7 p.m. Friday, September 23rd at the Cruz Phillips Funeral Home in Tama. In Clarence, Barnell, known as Barney H. Rowald, age 95, passed away Tuesday, September 13th at the Clarence Nursing Home. Funeral services will be held at 10:30 Friday, September 16th at St. John's United Church of Christ in Clarence. Visitation will be from 9:30 until service time at the church. Burial will be at the Loudon Cemetery. The Chapman Funeral Home has Barney and his family in their care. Condolences and memories can be left at chapmanfh.com. From Shelby, North Carolina, Randall Gene McSwain, age 67, passed away Saturday, September 10, at his home, surrounded by family. Donations can be made in his memory to Hospice Cleveland County, 951 Wendover Heights Drive in Shelby, North Carolina, or to a charity of the donor's choice. A celebration of life service will be held at 2 p.m. Saturday, September 17th at the Chapel of Cecil M. Barton Funeral Home. The family will receive friends 1 hour prior to the service from 1 to 2 p.m. The family would like to extend a special thank you for the generosity of Maddie, Lardell, Reese, and Charday for their love and care. From Fairfax, David Yanichek, 69, of Greenfield, formerly of Fairfax, passed away Monday, September 12, at the UIHC. A celebration of life gathering and visitation will be held from 1 to 3 p.m. Sunday, September 18th, at Brosh Chapel and the Ava Center in Cedar Rapids, 2121 Bowling Street, Southwest. Burial will follow at the Czech National Cemetery. Memorials may be directed to the family and online condolences expressed at broshchapel.com. The final obituary from West Des Moines, Ava Rose Vasky, passed away September 11, 2022, with her family by her side at the Mayo Clinic in Rochester. Ava courageously battled cancer for 11 months. Mass of Christian burial for Ava will be held at 10 a.m. Saturday, September 17th at St. Teresa Catholic Church. Visitation will be held from 5 to 8 p.m. Friday, September 16th at Caldwell Parish Funeral Home and Crematory. Interment will be held in Jordan Cemetery. Turning now to the sports page, high school football, this story titled Janus Emerges as Legit Threat for West High. He's a very respectful kid. It's impossible not to notice how many times Christian Janus said, "Yes, sir," when you talk to him. Makes you think he must have some sort of military background, or perhaps he's from the South, where that seems to be a common colloquialism. When it comes to the senior wide receiver from Iowa City West, it's actually both. He was born in Tennessee. His father, Christopher, is a master sergeant in the Army, an ROTC military instructor at the University of Iowa. I wouldn't say my dad is a strict guy, but it teaches you manners and stuff like that, just like every dad's supposed to, Christian Janus said. It just helps you with conversations and how you treat and respect others, helps you know how to treat seniority. The Januses have lived around the country, as you'd expect. They went from Tennessee to Kentucky to Louisiana to upstate New York before settling in Iowa City at the end of Christian's eighth grade school year. That's tough on any kid. He has to leave friends and then find new ones every place he goes. Sports have been a great way for him to do that. He's a high-level swimmer, a top-notch sprinter on the West track and field team, and an emerging wide receiver on the football field. I'll abbreviate the column to say, Janus has 5 receptions, including a touchdown in West's opener last year against Cedar Rapids Kennedy, when he suffered a broken collarbone in the third quarter that forced him to miss the rest of the season. His quickly expanding game tape should help him get noticed by others. West at 2-1 plays tonight at Davenport North, 0-3. It was just kind of a reminder that this is where I want to be, this is what I want to do, Janus said of his Kinnick experience last week. Obviously, not having a junior season makes it hard. Right now, I feel like I've just got to keep playing how I'm playing. Let the pieces align, and whatever happens, happens. But I feel like I'm in a good spot. This high school volleyball notebook story by Jeff Linder, the title, New Look, West Liberty, continues to click. The calendar reads 2022, but for the West Liberty High School volleyball team, it's year 1 AD, as in after Dofelt. Last year's co-state player of the year, Macy Dofelt, has graduated and moved on to Drake University. For the team she left behind, life goes on, and it's going quite well. The Class 3A state runner-up last year, West Liberty has retooled under two remaining all-staters, seniors Monica Morales and Brooklyn Bice. The Comets are 16-4 and ranked number 4 in 3A. We knew we had to grow around these two, Coach Ruben Galvin said Tuesday, between matches of a triangular with Anamosa and Cedar Rapids Xavier. Talk about experience, these two haven't. We're a more balanced team. When you have a player like Macy, you're going to go to her. That gave us time for everybody else to grow up last year. Morales leads the state at digs, and Bice is setting at an 8.87 assist per set clip. Western Dubuque claimed sole possession of first place in the MVC Valley Division Tuesday, outlasting Cedar Rapids Kennedy in 5 sets. And Saturday is another relatively full tournament day with events at Springville, Van Horn, Lisbon, and Manchester, among other sites. In events of area interest today in high school football, Linmar is at Washington at Kingston Stadium, and Iowa City West is at Davenport North. In volleyball, Iowa City West is at Prairie, Bellevue Marquette at Cedar Valley Christian, Regina is at West Branch, and a high school cross-country meet finds Marion and Regina at Cascades Invitational at 4 p.m. Washington, Jefferson, Kennedy, Linmar, Liberty are at Cedar Falls Ron Engel Classic. That takes place at the Birdsall Park. That starts at 5:40. In girls swimming, Tipton and Vinton Shelsberg are at Linmar. City High, Muscatine, Waterloo West are at at Iowa City West's Finkbine Golf Course today at 1 o'clock. Turning now to the Hoopla page, the front page story by Diana Nolan is titled Portraits in Courage. Revival Theater Company is bringing new life to a forgotten musical about an unforgettable tragedy. Despite winning 5 Tony Awards, including Best Musical, Titanic was eclipsed by the Oscar-winning movie, both of which hit theaters in 1997. 25 years later, an A-list cast of local actors and musicians will be leading the way September 23 to 25 in Revival Theater's production on stage at Theater Cedar Rapids. In brief, if you go, the Revival Theater Company presents Titanic the Musical. It's at Theater Cedar Rapids, 102 3rd Street Southeast, September 23rd to 25th. Shows are 7:30 p.m. Friday, 2:30 and 7:30 Saturday, and 2:30 on Sunday. Tickets are $22 to $46. Theater Cedar Rapids box office, 319-366-8591. In the music category also, Making Ukuleles Cool Again is the title of an article by Dave Gilderubio. In the world of stringed instruments, the four-string ukulele has a small and kitschy niche that was associated with the likes of the late Tiny Tim and vaudeville. More recently, it's gotten a slightly cooler image as artists ranging from actress Zooey Deschanel to musicians Nellie McKay and Pearl Jam's and Eddie Vedder have been using the uke to express themselves. But the biggest advance is coming courtesy of Jake Shimabukuru, but unlike what Bella Fleck has done for the banjo, Jake is doing the same thing for his humble instrument associated with Hawaii and tropical shirts. If you go, in brief, Jake with Justin Kawika Young is appearing at the Englert Theater in Iowa City, 7:30 p.m. Wednesday. Tickets are $23 to $39.50, including fees. You can find tickets at theenglert.org/events. In the food category, Break Time is the title of an article by Emily Anderson. Andy Dutmeyer and Vic Cooper weren't planning on opening a restaurant anytime soon, but when a friend who works in commercial realty told them a space was opening up in downtown Cedar Rapids, they figured they might as well take a look. The space on the ground floor of Alliant Tower used to house Fresh Deli and Grill, which closed at the end of June. Less than 6 weeks later, Dittmeyer and Cooper's new restaurant called Tower Cafe opened its doors. In brief, if you go, it's located at 200 First Street Southeast in Cedar Rapids. Hours are 7:30 a.m. to 2 p.m. Monday to Friday. They're closed on the weekends. The phone number there is 319-200-5999. They have dine-in or carry-out, and online ordering is available at towercafecr.com. Also in the food category, Elijah Desius' story, Chop House Adds a Reserve. About a year after they first opened, Chop House Downtown, in short order, owners Ryan, Joe, Avia, Baluro are expanding with a new event center. Chop House Reserve, opening in the ground level space adjacent to Chop House Downtown, plans to open by the end of October in the corner of the Hock or Hatch building in the 400 block of First Street Southeast. The new space, about 6,000 square feet, will feature an upscale area with a chef's table and partitioned areas for more intimate gatherings. With the connected Chop House Downtown, up to 15,000 square feet is available to rent for private parties. Chop House Reserve's space alone can accommodate 237 guests. The new space can accommodate everything from small birthday parties and cocktail hours to large company gatherings. With exposed brick similar to Chop House Downtown, the space, which was built in 1899, will bring modernized, luxe accommodations. With an on-site kitchen, relatively uncommon with local event centers, parties can take advantage of catering opportunities with Chef Joe. The building's unique features and history will also be put to use. Eventually, the vault will be turned into a wine cellar from which planners can hand-select their wine choice. And a new McDonald's location opened September 7 at 4520 First Avenue Northeast, south of Von Maur's parking lot at the Lindale Mall in Cedar Rapids. The new location, which opened after several months of construction, replaces the Thomas Park franchise up the street in Marion. That location closed August 18. The changes, planned over the past several years, are among the first made under operator Justine Macchione. She now owns and operates 25 corporate restaurants under McDonald's Restaurants of Iowa. 21 of the locations were formerly owned by franchisee Kevin O'Brien, who retired last October. 3 were formerly owned by Jerry Murozinski, who retired in December. I have many visions for the area over the next several years. In addition to remodeling several locations, I'm exploring rebuilding some of the older buildings, Macchione told the Gazette. Growth is never off the table, especially with the support we receive in the Cedar Rapids area. And lastly, in the food category, Trailside tasting tickets are now on sale to Sample Beer on the Prairie, September 28. The annual event at the Indian Creek Nature Center gives attendees the chance to sample a wide variety of local craft beer at stations alongside heavy appetizers. Producers this year include Back Pocket Brewing, Big Grove Brewery, BIT Brewery, Iowa Brewing Company, Lion Bridge Brewing Company, Arden Creek Winery, Cedar Ridge Winery, Wild Culture Kombucha, and Wilson's Orchard and Farm. Tickets are available at the Indian Creek Nature Center and start at $40. Turning to the Business 380 page, this story is by Gage Miskimen for the Gazette. A look inside Uptown Marion's new Broad and Main building. The first Broad and Main building in the heart of Uptown Marion will welcome its first residents today. Community members got to take a sneak peek at the new apartments during the Marion Economic Development Corp's Industry and Development Bus Tour Tuesday afternoon. An official grand opening is set for the middle of November. Before stopping at the new mixed-use complex, the tour also included a look at work on the new Marion Independence Stadium behind Marion High School, the Labita Mattress Factory, and Victory Sports Center. The first Broad and Main building, which has been under construction since fall of 2021, is mostly finished. Crews are making the final touches on paint around the building, and the lobby still needs to be finished. Kayla Toll, vice president of the properties for Eagle View Partners, the developer of the project, said the first building's residential floors so far are 60% leased. The building's top two floors consist of 35 one- and two-bedroom apartments, with the first floor made up of 8 commercial spaces. 4 of the commercial spaces already are leased. The apartments feature floor-to-ceiling windows overlooking Uptown Marion, wood floors, an open kitchen space, a working area, and washers and dryers. The leased spaces so far include an interior design company, a hair salon, a smoothie shop, and an infant and children's clothing store. Toll said the goal is to get a brewery or restaurant on the west side of the building, closest to the City Square Park. The space is a blank slate, but we're hoping to get someone signed sooner rather than later. We just want to make sure they are a good blend with Broad and Main and the Uptown as a whole. Medco next month will be moving its office in City Hall to the west end of the second floor, looking out at City Square Park and 7th Avenue. The space, which still is being finished, has a full outdoor patio, a long and an open classroom concept with co-working spaces and a couple conference rooms. All the spaces will be used by our business partners, Medco President Nick Glue said. We're excited to roll this out. The other building, slated to open in late 2023 or early 2024, will be residential only with around 40 units. A groundbreaking for that project is expected to come in the next couple weeks. The costs are $13 million for the first building and $16 million for the second. Turning now to the weather page, we are looking for a high of 85 in Cedar Rapids for today, partly cloudy and breezy with wind out of the south at 10 to 20. Iowa City is looking for a high of 86, in both areas a low of 63. Looks about the same tomorrow, again partly cloudy and breezy. A chance of showers rolls in for Saturday and Sunday. The normal high for today is 75 and the normal low is 52. The record high of 97 was set in 1939. The record low of 31 degrees was set in 2007. Sunset tonight is at 7:16 p.m., sunrise tomorrow at 6:48 a.m., giving us 12 hours and 29 minutes of daylight. We are in the waning gibbous moon phase with moon rise at 10:04 p.m. and set at 1:37. And that does it for the reading of the Cedar Rapids Gazette for today, Thursday, September 15, on IRIS. I've been your reader, Kathleen. You can access a copy of today's reading online at iowaradioreading.org. Thank you for listening and have a great, safe day.
From the Bureau of Economic Geology, this is Earth Date. What exactly is fossil water, and why have we consumed so much of it? No, it's not a new brand of bottled water imported from the days of dinosaurs. Fossil water came from melting ice sheets, ancient lake systems, and a generally wetter climate tens to hundreds of thousands of years ago. It percolated into porous rocks, which were then buried under deep layers of sediment, where it was sealed off from the surface, and there it stayed, until farmers discovered it. And in the second half of the 20th century, they started drilling wells into fossil aquifers and pumping like mad, turning sunny, dry places into acres and acres of green farmland. Crop supplies boomed, food became cheaper and more plentiful, grown in formerly parched places like California and Kansas, and shipped around the world for people like you and me to eat, ingesting fossil water with it. The trouble is, fossil water is a finite resource, and new studies suggest that many fossil aquifers may become depleted this century, so that we won't be able to rely on them any longer. This could mean that the crops that depend on them could become less plentiful and more expensive again. All the while, population will likely increase, the climate will likely warm, our demand for water will continue to climb, which means we'll have to adapt to the lack of fossil water, just as we adapted to its discovery, this time with more efficient crops and farming methods and more efficient use. For Earth Date, I'm Scott Tinker.
Earth Date is produced by the Bureau of Economic Geology at the University of Texas at Austin, with support from Schlumberger, helping oil and gas companies increase production and efficiency while lowering environmental impact. You can hear more Earth Date stories at earthdate.org.